Good day, everyone, everywhere, and special greetings to all those seated in heavenly places in Jesus. The name of this broadcast is Cross the Border, and I'm Nicholas, and this is a live prophecy reality edition. Yeah, come here once a week, every Wednesday morning, so people must be forgetting because people are not showing up. Anyway, good to see you there in the chat room, Fireman Mike. Okay, let's see, First Amendment Radio. I've been working on our Mobi app. If you go to firstamendmentradio.com or .net /MOBI, you'll get our Mobi app. And I now have on the Mobi app, I have a page. Let's see, where's that page at? For the chat room. I believe this is it here. Nope, that's not it. But if I click on this button here, you'll see there's new buttons on the app. And there's one that says video chat. So if you go to that one there, it opens up to the same chat room we have in our chat room and also has a screen there, a rumble screen, live screen that 24/7 plays First Amendment Radio. So wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, you can go to listen to First Amendment Radio. All the podcasts are available, and I'm still working on it. You can see the buttons at the top. Four of them are operative, and three of them are not yet, but they will all be operative. Give me a couple weeks. But I got far enough. So far I have the opening page, which is the listen page, and it has First Amendment Radio live stream at the top, and then all of the podcasts for the entire week. You just you press the forward arrow there, and it goes to the next day. So there's all the programs for the week are there, and they're all updated hourly on First Amendment Radio. We have automation to do that. Computers, imagine that. So the programs within an hour or two at the most, but usually right away they get uploaded. And so a program that was just played will be available almost immediately, you know, give it 10 or, you know, maybe 10 minutes after the top of the hour when it ends, and it will be uploaded there. Everybody hearing me good? Forgot to turn my voice monitor. There, I can see my voice now. And so that's how that works. And then I have one with the people on it there. So you click on that. There's links there right now, but I'm still working on it. I'll get some graphics and stuff, but I have links to all the web pages for the programs that we have on First Amendment Radio. There's more to be added. That's the page I'm working on right now. So getting the links there was the first thing I needed to do. And then I have a give page, the one with the red heart symbol. Thank you for that sound check there, Fireman Mike. And if you click on that, you'll see, I say thank you for your faithful support. And please make out checks, money orders as follows, instructions so you can give to us because of the banking situation. We don't have a bank account that says First Amendment Radio. We have a trust account where all the money goes to that, and then it's credited to First Amendment Radio. And our trustee is over there. I mean, our treasurer trustee is over there. Getting the mail and, you know, making sure that all the money gets in the right places and everything gets paid for. So there's instructions there for giving. And as it says, Mark of the Beast CBDC is slavery. And I've got a little notice on there. You can read it for yourself. Because of the increased financial targeting of conservative organizations, we are preemptively backing away from PayPal et al. And asking our supporters to mail cash, checks, money order, or gold and silver to the above address. And there's a PDF. You can print labels. You know, you can print a label if you want to label labels to mail us a check or money order or cash every month. And we do get all the cash. Nobody sent us cash, and we haven't got it yet. And I'm going to do something, make sure people get noticed either by email if they give me an email with their donation, or I'll send them a card acknowledging their donation if they send it by mail. But sometimes it takes a little while. So that's all there. And then I've got three more buttons to fill up, and I'm sure I can find stuff to put on all of those. So developing the Mobi app, it's a web-based app. You can't find it in the app store. You can only open up your browser on your cell phone, on your stupid phone. I call them stupid phones. They call them smartphones. I say stupid phones, but open up a browser on your stupid phone and go to firstamendmentradio.net/Mobi and then save a link to that on your Surface. That's how I have it on my stupid phone. If I can show it to you. And, yeah, you can see right there that I have it on my phone. And, if I clear that, you'll see that I have a link on my Surface to that. So all I got to do is press that link and, it opens right up and starts play. Well, it doesn't start playing. You have to push the play button on that app. Although it does, it's supposed to autoplay on the net, but it usually doesn't. You have to start it. And then if you go to the opening page, which is our play page or a listen page, there's a refresh button there. It's a green refresh button on the very right. Because if you stop it when it's playing like this, it pauses it and it'll pick up later on. So if you want to pause it, and you can pick up where you left off in case you need to interrupt what you're listening to, and your device will pause it where you left off and pick it up. But if you want to pick up at the current spot, you got to press the refresh button. So that's all the instructions I'm going to give you on the Mobi app, but do remember it. And then send a link to everyone in your list so they can listen to First Amendment Radio. This is the only way. With shadow banning, we have no other way. So first get the link on your cell phone and then text it to everyone on your list so they can listen to First Amendment Radio and be affected by the gospel, okay, and the truth of God's word and a biblical worldview, because we want to give them all those things. And that way you can do that. That can be your evangelistic part, is to share the First Amendment Radio Mobi app on your device, since they can't get it in the store. But for those people who insist, we do have, as long as it will be in the Google store, is the Prophecy Reality News app. You can listen to that too. I have both on my phone. It depends on what I'm doing, which I prefer. So you can figure it out that too. But as far as getting to all the podcasts quickly without a lot of ado, I believe the Mobi page is going to be the best choice from now on, especially with the improvements that I'm making to it at this time. Okay, well, that's all we're going to say about that. I hope you all will enjoy that and take advantage of it. All right, news, current events in this first hour. And in the second hour, we've got two more installments of the Jorge Apocalyptic for you. So you'll want to stick around for that in the second hour. I am posting all these on the First Amendment Radio YouTube page because they're not giving me strikes for that yet. Yeah. So when it becomes more blatantly Antichrist driven over there at Google, YouTube, well, I believe they're shadow banning me because we do out the Antichrist here. I believe that is the whole reason that we're being shadow banned on YouTube, Gab. We weren't allowed on other places like, what do you call that? Rockfin and other places won't even allow us on. So they even have stricter, code of silence or censoring than YouTube. Yeah, some places do because they don't allow anything Protestant, evangelical, Bible teaching or Bible based on their platforms. Those are a good place to fish if you can get there, but if they don't allow you there in the first place, you can't fish there. At least I can throw my, hook into the pond at YouTube and fish there anyway, because I consider it their pond, you know, and I'll fish in their pond as long as they allow me to. When they kick me out of their pond, well, I guess I'll be done there. Okay, so anyway, we got news here. Elon, and this from Babylon Bee, are your most trusted news source on the net, besides First Amendment Radio, that is. Elon to stay as Twitter CEO after counting mail-in ballots. So just like the elections in America, if you don't get the result you like, you can count mail-in ballots and you can keep counting ballots until you get the result you want. Good job, Elon. Really kind of idiocy to put that poll out there. Doesn't he know that most of the people on Twitter are not going to like what he's doing? Yeah. Well, I think we should pray for this guy. Yeah. He might be facing his mortality soon. Because he talked about, I'm not suicidal, you know, last week. And then they tried to attack him and his son, X, or something. So I think that's his son's name, X. Yeah. It's my son, my ex. He's not my ex-son. It's pretty weird anyway. But hey, even Elon Musk could be saved, you know? I don't know if his name is already written in the Book of Life like mine was from the foundation of the world. We don't know. So we can pray for people like Elon Musk and even shameful Donald Trump, who introduced the jab and shut down the country. And sometime in the last week, he had a gay gala event at Mar-a-Lago, you know, just to prove to all those people out there who thought he was a baby Christian and saved. Well, he's not. I'm sorry. You know, you don't throw gala events to celebrate the new Gay Marriage Act at Mar-a-Lago without, you know, offending your Christian base. So I think these things, he's his own worst enemy. I think that there's not a chance in Hades anymore of Donald Trump becoming president. And I think by 2024, it will be more than evident. I could be wrong, but yeah. It probably will be DeSantis. But all politicians come with baggage and none of them can be trusted. Yeah. The corrupting nature of man, it's just too easy to be corrupted. And we all have to admit, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. All right. Well, let's see what else we get from, I think they had a couple more here. They have a lot of advertising, but I did like this one. Bruce Wayne pulls Arkham inmates asking if he should step down as Batman. And same results as Elon Musk. So yeah, you gotta be careful what you ask for. Yeah. Thank you for that. Let's see. Hallmark researchers say they're close to developing a second movie plot. I guess that's just supposed to be funny. Maybe that's Hallmark Network, but they've gone in for the whole, they bought in for the whole, gay mirage thing. And, so Hallmark's done with now. And I'm done with them. So never mind about that. Let's see. Blithering idiot of a husband arranged throw pillows in wrong order. I guess some people might think that funny. That's a married people comedy there, I guess. Here's one. Washington Post lowers flag to half staff for journalists suspended from Twitter. Okay. Chris Tomlin proud to unveil completely new and original Christmas song. Silent Night. Yeah. And that's it. That's all we get from, that's our laughs and our giggles for the day. Now we have to get into serious news, right? And I guess the question of the day is, if we go with this one here, no, this one. Yeah, this one here. What's love got to do with it, right? Oh, no, wait a minute. That's an old song from the past. It's what's the government got to do with it? That's what we're going with. What's the government got to do with marriage? And I found this article because I've been thinking about this for months on and off, thinking about writing an article about it. And voila, you know, somebody did it for me at The American Thinker. Although I might have wrote a little bit differently, a little more Bible-based. But anyway, it's something that I can play on here. The government should get out of the marriage business. I could not agree more. That's the title of the article over at American Thinker. There's a way to undercut the left's sustained attack on religion, expressed most recently through its assault on traditional heterosexual marriage. The answer is to take government out of marriage. You know, while continuing to allow it to control what are essentially the business aspects of two people joining together. There's a way to undercut the left's sustained attack on religion, expressed most recently through its assault on traditional heterosexual marriage. The answer is to take government out of marriage while continuing to allow it to control what are essentially the business aspects of two people joining together. The Respect for Marriage Act is no such thing. As a legal brief, and as legal briefs so commonly say, Tanya Bergoggle has clearly shown, arguments are incorporated by reference herein. While she discusses marriage's proper role in society, space likely prevented her from reviewing the government's role in marriage. So let's begin at the beginning. With ancient colonies, with ancient colonies, and that's one thing that I really didn't like about the article. It only goes back to the beginning, to the American colonies. In the southern colonies, while marriage was performed before a magistrate, divorce was unacceptable because the Church of England did not sanction it. And actually, there was no marriage licensing in early America. And there hasn't been really any marriage licensing, except where governments are totalitarian, or it was illegal to marry someone from another race. That was in America. So you needed a marriage license to marry someone who was not your race. And the fact is this, in a free land like America, nobody needs a marriage license to be married. Okay. I've been married several times. I've been married. I delegated that authority. It was delegated to the pastor and the church that I was at, and we had our own church marriage certificate with witnesses signing on it, and on it it also had our vows that we made to each other. And so you don't need to have a marriage license from a state to get married, and I've discussed this before. And there's no reason for the government to be even in the marriage business at all. What do they need to know, even if you're married for? Okay. For paying unlawful taxes, you know, if you signed up for that, if you signed up privately and contracted with the Social Security Administration and the federal government to fill out a 1040 inquisition form every year, and then they have a marriage exemption there or something where you pay less taxes. But I think it's just head of household now. And so they need some way to quantify that on their legal documents once you accept your position as a slave. Because that's what the whole thing is about. It's about your position as a slave. You're owned by them. So you have to report to them and fill out 1040 financial inquisition forms every year. And that's the only reason the government now needs to. But why do they even need that? And that's what this article pretty much outlines. Okay. He says marriage was an explicitly secular act in the New England colonies. New England civil courts could dissolve marriages, but did so only rarely. And so there is a part in marriage for dissolution, because marriage, because all those things needed to be announced publicly if you were going to be married, because you couldn't have someone going out there and marrying someone that was already married, whatever. So there are some checks on marriage that, really need to be recorded publicly, but the government does not need to be involved in it for any reason whatsoever, except perhaps in recording relationships. And that's where this guy gets to. He goes on, courts were awarded courts also awarded property and typically granted child custody to the father. So this is a court action. Because children regarded as economic assets, the concept of the welfare of the child developed later when the economic value of children declined. Yes, how did that happen? Today, he says, in my home state of Florida, a judge, pastor, even a notary, I got mine to officiate my grandson's wedding, can legitimate a marriage. Similar laws exist all across America. He says nothing about the Bible here. The Bible is every man and woman's license to marry, according to the dictates of the Bible, right? Okay, you can't hide one marriage while you marry someone else. You're not supposed to marry someone else. You can't remarry someone that you divorced before, according to the Bible, that married someone else in between. Anyway, we'll pick up here when we get back from this break. This break just came too fast. Okay, I'll be back in a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Cross the Border. This is a live prophecy reality edition.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Arthur, and I'd like to introduce you to my latest book, Reformed Prophecy Interpretation, an apology for Reformed premillennial historicism in the 21st century. As with primitive biblical Christianity, historicism is the method of prophecy interpretation restored with the advent of the Protestant Reformation, and had become so widely held that for a long time it was called the Protestant view. My book is not so much about the errors of dispensationalism or amillennialism. Rather, it is about the historicist alternative to understanding many of the same passages from the vantage point of prophecy fulfilled in history. For those that desire more than mere hypotheses, bolstered with conjectured speculation, those who require explicit biblical exegesis and verified historical fulfillment, and are not willing to accept speculation as anything other than what it is, speculation, not truth, this book is for you. Over the last century, this method of interpretation has become almost completely forgotten, even by Protestants, in the face of a method that is based almost entirely on future speculation, rather than fulfilled prophecy in history. In my book, I examine the reasons for this and investigate some of the prophecy which has been fulfilled in the interim, as well as present an apology for Reformed premillennial historicism to the 21st century. If you're interested in a copy of my book, you can go to my website, crosstheborder.org, and get more information there. Or you may also find it at Amazon. Well, when I left off, I was talking about marriage and what's the government got to do with it. And I guess the answer would be, should be, absolutely nothing. I think that was the answer to another song. War, what is it good for? Okay, so anyway, if we look to the Bible just briefly, we know that God joined the first man and woman together. So they definitely had a license from God to get married because God made Eve for Adam. But then as we go through the families of the patriarchs and Israel, we see that it was the father of the bride who had the honor of officiating the wedding. The father of the bride, imagine that. And that's the way it still should be today. We still have a vestige of that left in most marriage ceremonies, although at least most in the last century. I don't know what's going on today out there. All kinds of bizarre stuff, but... Okay, I hope this is an actual call and not just another interruption. Your name and where you're calling from? Yep. Okay. So we had the father of the bride. That's what we get. So that makes marriage a family rite. Now the church tries to claim it. Of course, the Catholic Church claims everything it can. Some churches today claim that it is a religious and church rite, but it is not. The Bible clearly demonstrates that it is a family rite, meaning rite being short for ritual, okay? It's a family rite. It's a family ritual. It belongs to the family. It belongs to family government. And I was talking about that vestige of that is left in most marriages, and especially most over the last century, that where the pastor who has been delegated that family authority by the family itself, see, because you have the right to delegate authority if you have it, right? And so most families delegate that, or most Christian families delegate it to the church. I did that with my last wedding. I delegated to the church to where I got married, and they didn't require a license from the state to marry me because they were not a 501c3 church. Okay, so it's a family right. It's not a state right. It's not a state government right. It's not a church right. But the family can delegate it. Well, they could delegate it to the local magistrate if they want, or the ship captain, whatever. Or the father of the bride can do it himself, because that's what I see demonstrated in the Bible. So that's where the right really belongs and where it's vested by God, apparently. Okay, I see nothing else in the scripture about the church having the right, owning that right and having that authority. But as I said, it can be delegated. And so this author, anyway, he goes into Premonocter and what David's son Absalom, he digresses in the article. So we'll just skip that part there. He says, today in my home state of Florida, a judge, pastor, even notary can officiate a wedding. Yeah, you can delegate that authority to anyone you want. To Mickey Mouse if you want, I guess. But the fact is, you don't need a state-issued license. The IRS, whatever agencies, the driver's license, they all accept a marriage certificate that is a bona fide marriage certificate. And you can make up your own, get your witnesses to sign it. You can have it officiated at church, but just it has to be, you know, and it should be announced publicly, because that's part of it. Is there anyone who has any reason why? That's the other lawful part that is added, and that's why marriages are supposed to be published, so that if anyone has a reason, hey, I know that guy is a scoundrel, he's got three other wives in six other states, or six other wives in three other states or something. So, you know, just to make sure. But, you know, usually it's young people that are getting married, and everyone knows, their families know that, you know, the guy is only 17 or 18, maybe 20, and he doesn't have six other wives in three other states. And there's no other reason. He's not promised to anyone else. He's not betrothed, or the wife's not betrothed. That's why the question is asked. Is there anyone who has any reason? It's a legal question for the legal standing of the parties being married. If they don't have that legal standing, then it would be exposed at that point rather than later when more damage can be done. Okay. And that's the legality of marriage there. But like I said, what's the state got to do with it? It should have absolutely nothing to do with it. And then speaking of licensing, see, God gives a man and a woman a license to marry according to what we read in the Bible and all the stipulations and everything that's contained in the Bible that has to do with marriage and being eligible to be married. Okay. And that's why we would ask the question, is there anyone who has a reason why these two should not be married? But the state, because God won't give certain parties a license to marry, because he does not. God does not give a man a license to marry a man, or a woman a license to marry a woman, or to marry their dog, or whatever. Or three men to marry two women or anything like that. There's no license in the Bible for any of that. The Bible only says what it says, and it says some things are an abomination, so they're definitely not licensed by God Almighty. So all God's people and every man and woman already has a license to marry, and it is in the Word of God, because, you know, let every soul be subject to the higher power. The higher authority. And who is the highest authority of all but God Almighty? He is the higher power. And if you're subject to him, then you're subject to every lawful authority below him. And if there's a lawful authority below God that is in disagreement with God's law, then that is no authority at all. It may be a power. They may have the power to persecute or even kill you or punish you, but their authority is an illegitimate authority. And their power is a usurpation of power. So anyway, let's get to the meat of this guy's article here. To those of us with Christian backgrounds, find the concept of gay marriage repugnant. Amen to that. Homosexuality and its related sexual deviances, such as Sam, Brenton, Rachel, Levine, Brittany, Griner, come readily to mind, may not be the province of the state to regulate, but blessing them with the epithet of marriage is morally obscene. God created male and female. The divine mandate is for one male to become husband to one woman and vice versa. But relegating marriage to a secular status pushes it back to the state's authority to affirm or deny. So is the Bible going to deny anyone the right to marriage that God says can be married? Well, no. They don't have the right. But I guess in some governments, in some ages, and some totalitarians would and will do that. And the government likes to get authority and money for licensing anywhere they can get it. You know, one thing about dictators and tyrants is they're in love with power. Anyway, the article continues. At this point, the linguists jump in. While most dictionary definitions speak of weddings and so on, marriage has been much larger semantic range. It's broader sense. It speaks of matching two things, not necessarily people, and joining them together. Obviously, this is parallel to the wedding ceremony, but that's primarily because things in a wedding are people and are joined together. The matching and joining are the root concepts. Thus, referring to the two people joining their lives as a marriage is less than exact language. A different choice of words would eliminate the moral revulsion of Christians at gay marriage, gay mirage, while retaining all the legal nuances. As far as the state is concerned, let's rename this joining process as a life partnership. I think they already call that. I saw in some thing the other day that someone introduced this other guy as his partner. I thought, oh, they're in business together. Well, yeah, they're in business together, all right. It's monkey business. It's sin business. But anyway, this is a more exact term and completely lacks religious connotations. It directly expresses the intent of two people to share their lives, whether religious or not. It also focuses on legal issues involved. And so anyway, there's this article, and it's at AmericanThinker.com. But I think that we need to, that the government, but I don't think they're going to arrange the affairs so that it just gets down to legal definitions and a shared legal ownership of property. And that's basically what it gets into. These two people are having a partnership, a sharing of property for business or otherwise. And there has to be a legal or contractual agreement there. And the government's only business is upholding the law of contracts, and mainly that through the courts rather than what it allows and doesn't allow. As long as the contract is lawful, then it has standing in the courts. And that should be the end of it for the government and marriage. There should be no Obergefell. There should be none of that. It's just that these evil people, they wanted the same status as lawfully married people. They couldn't get it from God because they can't rewrite the Bible. So they got it from their God, the state. And that is essentially what worshiping the beast means, is that you put the state in the place of God. You make the state your highest authority, and that way you worship the beast. And that could be even considered a mark of the beast. So when you see two people that are not married by the law of God, but married by the law of the state, contrarily, you can say that they are worshipers of the beast. And that thing that they're flouting and putting on display for everyone to see in their life is a mark of the beast, or a mark of their allegiance and worship of the beast. So we know what happens to people that worship the beast and its image. Well, they all end up in hell, unfortunately. So if anyone's listening, they don't like what I'm saying, all I can say is repent, you know? But don't try to say that God has changed his mind because the government of man has changed their mind. God has not changed his mind. And you've accepted another God, another authority, to give you license to do that which God says is unlawful and an abomination. And I think that's about all I need to say about that for now. Okay, well, let's see what else we got. Boy, I could do the whole 2 hours on news. Should I or should I not? Well, nobody showed up. I don't think really anybody cares what I have to say anymore. Maybe I'm just doing this because I think it's fun. Yes, and necessary. There is a message here. Yeah. Everybody getting the message? Yeah, well, that could be another reason why I'm so unpopular, is the message. Okay, let's see what else we got here. I found another article. Is America falling like Rome? And last week I talked about the barbarians from the South. Yeah. And so, like me, someone else wrote an article on When the news of the Battle of Saratoga reached Britain, a young Scottish barrister told economist Adam Smith, "If we go on at this rate, the nation must be ruined." And Adam Smith responded, "Be assured, young friend, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation." By that he meant that a nation can absorb a lot more blows than pessimists tend to think. And boy, that's become so obvious today. I think Adam Smith had something going on there, if he could say that. And it's definitely proved to be true, because America has taken a lot of blows and, you know, has not fallen yet, but it is falling. And whether it will still be falling when Christ returns, well, I guess that's goes without question. After quoting Adam Smith's answer at the beginning of the article, and after reviewing the ills that beset America, Victor Davis Hanson, I guess writing on, had a very concerning article on the future of America, concluded his reflection with the following statement. "We have seen lots of cultural revolutions in this country, but never one that's so singularly focused on raising the foundations of America until now. Yes, there's a lot of ruin in great nations, but even America is by now running low on it," meaning that the ruin is becoming so great that it's becoming likely to fall. In all fairness, it has to be said that such a terrible sentence perfectly reflects the reality of the country as it has become today. We are $31 trillion in collective debt. The military is politicized and short of recruits, and they're killing people as fast as they can. He doesn't realize that in this article, is that they're killing people, that the genocide, the forced euthanasia is on purpose. American people are witnessing the breakdown of basic norms essential for civilized life. Says old Cairo seems safer than an after-hours subway ride or stroll at dusk in many major American cities. Medieval's London's roadways were likely cleaner than Market Street in San Francisco, not to mention the fact that speech was freer in the 1920s America than it is now. Nor can the abject, deliberate humiliation suffered in Kabul be forgotten, when the worst U.S. administration ever decided to flee and abandon to the terrorist Taliban a huge, remodeled airbase, tons of billions of dollars in military hardware, 1 billion embassy, and thousands of friends. In addition, FBI is corrupt and discredited, collaborating with Silicon Valley's big tech companies to suppress free speech and warp elections. And it goes on and on. That's the state of our nation today. And it's a very sad state of a nation. But there is a nation within a nation. And there is a nation that covers the whole earth and is within all of the nations of men. All the temporal nations of men have in them another nation, another constituency. Not the people of the world, but the people of the kingdom of heaven. And that is the kingdom that will last forever. And that is the cure to all the ills, because the kingdoms of this world are passing away very quickly, as we can see. And how long before Christ comes and obliterates them all? Not long. You know, even if it's 25 or 30 years off, it's not long. And for those of you that are curious and wonder what the Bible would have to say about that, I have an article on my website. If you go to crosstheborder.org or nicholasarthur.wordpress.com, you'll see an article up there at the top. It says, "What year is it?" And it has an outline in it from the scripture itself that traces a chronology from Adam and Eve. Well, specifically from Adam being created on the sixth day and Eve, and to today, deriving as much of that timeline up through the time of Christ, we have that complete timeline in the Bible itself with a few very small gaps. So it's not exact. I'm going to say that it's within a few years, 2 or 3 years, at least, or at the most would be the difference between, and I have the year, the final year is 2055. So you might want to check that out for yourself. I'm hoping it's a little sooner, but unfortunately I can't, you know, by all of my study, as much as I desire it to be sooner than 2055, I can't make it happen that way. And I can't, you know, delude myself into believing that, oh, it's immediately or it could happen at any time. No, there are specific things in scripture, in the prophecy, that have not happened yet and are going to take some time to happen. But I believe that all indications are that we are that close, because 30 years, 25, 30 years is what it would be now. 2055, that would be 30 years from 2025 to 2055. So, I'd have to hang in there. Yeah. I'd be a very old man if I live till Christ returns. If it's going to be 2055, that means I have to live another 33 years. So I have to be well in excess of 100 years. And just, you know, I don't know, looking at 100-year-old people, it doesn't look that desirable to be honest. Sometimes I think even now I'd just as soon go home, but no. I there are things I want to do. I would like to finish the projects I'm on right now, and I would like to see at least one of my grandchildren or a couple of them take over the work here that I've begun, so that they can continue it until and it looks like that'll likely happen. Still praying about that one there. And my daughter does work with me, but her heart is not really in it yet. And so that's going to take a change, that I can't make, is you can't force anybody into the kingdom of God. You can only pray for them and pray that their name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world. And that when, God's Spirit moves on them, then it will become clear, yeah, where everybody stands and what the outcome will be. But the only one that we can really make sure of is ourselves, and then be that example for all the ones we love, so that they have an example to follow in, to live a godly life, and to walk in God's kingdom. And we all pray for all those we love continually, that we will see them in the resurrection. Because there's really, that's the most important thing, is to make the resurrection. Because what good is it if 100 people are saved by the work I do, and I miss it myself, right? Yeah, that's, what would that be like? And here I am at the end of the hour. It came too soon. I guess like David Knight, I'm going to need 3 hours if I keep this up, right? But no, I have too much other work to do this every day for, and we have lots of good programming, lots of good news programming. So I like to get on here and give a little of my biblical worldview on the news as I can. But in the next hour, I'm going to go ahead. I have this all queued up when we come back from the news. I will begin to play the next two segments in the Horae Apocalypticae. And those two segments are, let me look them up right here, right now. Number 11 is the mode, the manner, the plan, and order of the revelation from E.B. Eliot. And then number 12 is chapter 5 of his introduction, ensuing historical exposition. So it's kind of an introduction to what comes next, which after that would be the six seals opening. So that'll be next week. Well, that's all the time I have in this segment. I will come back after the news and introduce the two segments of the Hoary Apocalyptike. So don't go anywhere. I will be back.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ." This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Available for your Apple, Android device, and smartphone absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today, so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Across the Border. This is a live Prophecy Reality Edition, and we're going to continue our exposition of the Hoary Apocalyptike, actually the audible reading of it as I'm recording it and updating it for a new edition, which I'm likely going to publish on Amazon when it's done. And I'm going to try to get this thing done within a year. That shouldn't be too hard to do. It's not going to be easy, though, because there's four volumes. Is that right? Four volumes, yeah. That's a lot. But I'm already, as far as I can tell, I'm already more than halfway through volume one, because I'm just getting to, as far as my recording is concerned, not my playing out, but my recording, I've got to the end of the seventh seal and the beginning the trumpets. So I am proceeding regularly, and I should get this done. Like inside a year should be easy at the rate I'm going. But it means I have to let off a lot of other things that I would like to do too. But once I start something, and I just have to make it a priority to get it done. So quite an undertaking. But anyway, the Hoary Apocalyptike is the most exhaustive work ever done on the Revelation. E.B. Eliot, through his lifetime, did 5 editions of it, okay, continually updating it. And if he had lived until today, which is impossible, but if he had, he would have done probably 10 more editions on top of that to bring it up to date, because prophecy is continually unfolding in history or being fulfilled in history. So whatever's fulfilled needs to be included in the book. And that's what I'm doing with this edition and what I did with the last edition that I did. This one's just refining it and making it more readable because it was problematic. Tom Press was going to read it, but he told me that, I thought about it. It's just too hard to read. And he was right. It is. So you can imagine what I have to do to make it more readable. And that's exactly what I'm doing. But I figure if it makes it more readable so that I can actually read it out loud in an audible version, that should make it easier for everyone to read it. So that's kind of the effort here, without excluding anything. But I'm moving some things to the footnotes, so everything will still be there that was there. And some of the archaic language will be brought up to date, so it's a little more easy to read. But anyway, I'll run out of time if I don't start this, so let me start it right now. Hoary Apocalyptike, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century. Derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot. Updated, revised, and read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Introduction to The Prophecy of the Future. Chapter 4, The Mode and Manner, Plan and Order of the Revelation. And what then was to be the mode and manner of the unfolding before the august company thus assembled of this great revelation of the coming future? Was it to be simply, as in the case of some other revelations from God, by the reading out of what was written in the book? Not so. The subject matter therein contained was, in a manner, far more interesting, to be visibly enacted, even as in a living drama, and, for the requisite scenery and agency, alike heaven and earth put in requisition. Nor again was the beauty of dramatic plan and order to be wanting of the most perfect dramatic plan and order. And I think that, before entering on the figurative visions themselves, it would be of real advantage to consider these two points preparatory. I mean, first, the scenic imagery made use of in the development of the prophecy. Secondly, its plan, order, and chief divisions, as marked in the seven-sealed book containing it. Number 1. The apocalyptic scenery. As the reader will be aware, no detailed or connected account is given to us. We have only incidental notices of it. These, however, occur perpetually, and, if carefully gathered up and compared together, will be found wonderfully to harmonize, so as certainly to indicate a scenery designed and provided for the occasion, consistent and complete. And the importance of an early and familiar acquaintance with it will hence sufficiently appear, and is that from which the character and meaning of many important points in the apocalyptic prefiguration is alone to be deduced, and that too which connects and gives unity to them as a whole. The scene then first visible, and which remained stationary throughout the visions in the foreground, was that of the interior, as it were, of a temple, including in its secret and inmost sanctuary the throne of Yahuwah, already spoken of, and the blessed company attending around it. For this did not appear in open space, but as seems manifest in the progress of the prophetic drama, and is indeed in one place directly intimated, within the enclosure of a temple sanctuary. It was a temple resembling Solomon's, or yet more, the tabernacle framed earlier, after the pattern shown him in the mount, by Moses in the wilderness, although on a grander scale, at least as regards the inner sanctuary, and with other marked peculiarities, the which resemblance is also expressly intimated to us, for it was called upon one occasion the temple of God, on another, in words only referable to the Jewish temple or tabernacle, the temple of the tabernacle of witness in heaven. Moreover, in its parts and divisions, it well corresponded with that of Israel. The temple proper, or sanctuary, was similarly constituted of the holy place and that Most High, save that there was no veil, as of old, to separate them, the one being characterized by the golden altar of incense, and, I think, also by the seven burning lamps, the other by the divine glory and the Ark of the Covenant. Moreover, a court appeared attached to this sanctuary, just as to the Jewish, and one similarly marked by an altar of sacrifice standing in it. Beside that, there was the similar appendage of an outer court, also, as if of the Gentiles. As the visions proceeded, other objects appeared in connected landscape, around and beneath the temple. Nearest was seen the Mount Zion and its holy city, not the literal Jerusalem, which had been leveled to the ground and was now literally in bondage with her children, but that which, though in some things different, sufficiently resembled it to have the likeness at once recognized and to receive the appellation. Then beneath and beyond, far stretching, even as it might have appeared from that high mountain, whence were seen in a moment of time the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, the miniature but having landscape of the Roman Empire. Both the Mount Zion and the temple seem to have appeared high raised above the earth, although not altogether detached from it, and the former as well as the latter in near proximity to the heavenly glory within the sanctuary, so that while on the one hand the throne, which was in the innermost temple of vision, was said to be placed in heaven, and the temple was called the temple of the tabernacle of witness in heaven, a temple of which the altar court was the local scene evidently of the worship of the citizens of the holy city and Mount Zion. Yet on the outer court of the temple appeared accessible to the inhabitants of the earth below, and the holy city susceptible of invasion from them. Such was the standing scenery throughout the apocalyptic visions, nor was it depicted before St. John as a mere ornamental appendage, but was to be made use of, as I have already intimated, both emblematically and choreographic, to furnish figures and to designate localities, just as the scenery of the countries elsewhere prophesied of, with a view to the elucidation of the prophecy. It is to be remembered that the subject of the promised revelation was large and complex, the things which would happen thereafter. It was to be the same, in effect, as that which in its retrospective delineation constitutes the combined secular and ecclesiastical history of Christendom, the former, or secular, comprehending the grand political changes and revolutions of the Roman world, with the agencies instrumental in causing them, whether from without or from within, the latter or ecclesiastical, the outward fortunes, adverse or prosperous, of the church, its purity or corruptions of doctrine and worship, its general apostasy in the course of time, the coalescing of the apostatizing church with the world, and the separation, sufferings, faith, protection, and ultimate triumph of the saints, that is, of the true people, the spiritual Church of God. Such being the subject, so large, various, and complex, and the more complex from the events of its two great divisions, the secular and the ecclesiastical, often intermingling, the difficulty must be obvious of fitly exhibiting it, especially in respect of marking the due connection of events with the proper unity of effect. It is a difficulty that has been frequently felt and noticed by those who have delineated it in history, and must apply, of course, in full measure to its foreshowing in prophecy, which being the case, it is really most interesting to observe how suited the provision of the apocalyptic scenery was to lessen, if not to overcome it. In the first place, to represent Christ's church in respect of its worshiping, that church which is the house of the living God, there was the symbolic temple, its inmost or most holy place, including as the fit locality that part of the church constituency, the spirits of the just, which was then with Christ in heaven, and of which I have in the preceding chapter already spoken, also its outer sanctuary, or holy place, the vestibule and passage from the former, figuring by what might be noticeable within, the secret spirituality of the worship, as observed and cherished by Christ, the high priest, of his saints on earth, a point beautifully illustrated in the primary apocalyptic vision, and the temple court, and what passed therein, what was publicly observable in their public and corporate worship. Further, to symbolize their peculiar polity and citizenship, there appeared the holy city and Mount Zion, as if in visible picturing of St. Paul's ideal metropolitan city of the Christian body, with its base on earth, its mountaintop towards heaven, a symbol of the saints in truth, as significant as it was beautiful. For as much as they are members of a city and kingdom different from those of this world, while in the world, being not of the world, but having their citizenship in heaven. Besides all which, in order the better to signify events, views, or changes of importance, affecting or characterizing at any time the true apostolic line of the Christian ministry, there was the further and very remarkable help of the Apostle John's own presence on the scene, in his representative character, for such I doubt not will be found to have attached to him, himself to take part in the sacred drama, and enact, as a living actor, the role assigned to him. In contrast with all which, and to represent the world as distinguished from the saints, there was the terrain landscape of the apocalyptic or Roman earth, and its great city, the earth being the fit emblem of those who, in heart, only dwell on earth, in the event which was soon to take place of its inhabitants nationally abandoning paganism and professing Christianity. The symbol of the Gentile or outer court of the temple was at hand, as joined on to that of Israel, to represent their profession as proselytes, as excluded therefrom, to mark their complete and recognized apostasy. In the firmamental heaven, which overlooked the terrain landscape, and its sun, moon, and stars, there was that which might fitly designate, as in other prophecies, the secular powers of the world, whether in the luster of supremacy or as eclipsed and cast down. There was in the movement of atmospheric storms, the overflowing of rivers, and other such changes visibly passing from without upon the landscape, the ready symbol of foreign invasions, and again in its earthquakes, that of political commotions and revolutions from within. Further, as there seemed to have been a choreographic truth in the general landscape, and the four quarters of the Roman earth, with its inland sea, frontier rivers, and other notable localities to have been designated, there was a scenic facility of not merely symbolizing invasions or other such events, but of visibly marking the peculiar localities originating or affected by them, if in any case deemed essential. Besides all which, it must be remembered that there was the opportunity of superadding, from time to time, supplemental hieroglyphic signs or symbols, such as in chapters 12 and 13, for example, symbols associated, for the most part, with the scenic landscape. And finally, that of the connection of the histories of the world and of the church, the intermingling of events secular and ecclesiastical, might be easily and at once made manifest to the eye in the apocalyptic imagery, as its glances were directed from Mount Zion or to the temple, and what passed therein, to the earth below, and likewise, from the earth to the temple and Mount Zion. Number 2. As to the plan and order of the revelation. It is evident that the plan and order must have been essential to this distinct and extensive prophecy. And while, no doubt, one object of representing the events of the coming future, as written in the book, in the right hand of him that sat on the throne, was to mark them as all preordained in his eternal counsels, yet the chief object of their being there written must have been, I think, that of signifying what is now our purpose to consider, the plan, order, and grand divisions of the prophecy. The form of the book seems to have been that of a roll. Such was the common form of books among the Romans, and the almost universal one, I believe, at least of sacred books among the Jews. The divisions externally and at once apparent on it were twofold. First, the book appeared as one written within and without. Secondly, as one sealed with seven seals, the seals being all visible on the outside, and so arranged as that they could only be opened in succession. Further, after the seventh seal had been opened, intimation was given of their divisions. There appeared seven angels with seven trumpets, which trumpets were successively sounded, and symbolic visions connected with them, successively exhibited, each, I conceive, like the visions of the seals before them, with its counterpart written in the columns of the seven-sealed book. Finally, on the seventh trumpet sounding, and after a retrospective digression, somewhat long and varied, seven vials were poured out, each having its subject described in the book also, the last reaching to the close of the present dispensation and the triumph and glorious reign of Christ and his saints. Thus the question arises, what might the nature and relation of these several divisions be? What of the writing within and without? What of the seals, trumpets, and vials? And as regards that primary mark of division, its being written within and without, does it not seem natural to suppose that, according to the forms of writing then customary, what was without might be intended as part supplemental of that within, because it would be on the backside of whichever sealed page of the scroll presently unrolled, supplemental, not accidentally, or as occasioned by an unexpected and overflowing redundancy of the matter, so as was often the case in the rolls of human writing, but purposely and with premeditated design, perhaps so in fact to answer to and comprehend the very retrospective explanatory digression after the seventh trumpet just spoken of. Such, I think, it will prove. Again, as to the relative chronological position of the apocalyptic seals, trumpets, and vials, would not the most natural arrangement of them seem to be that which supposes each of the latter series of sevens to be consecutive on the former, the seventh seal comprehended within it the seven trumpets, and the seventh trumpet the seven vials, the trumpets carrying on the history chronologically from the end of the sixth seal, and the vials from the end of the sixth trumpet. Such, in fact, appears to be the self-evident simplicity of this view of the apocalyptic structure, that I think, to the mind of the evangelist, it must almost at once have suggested itself, and almost at once carried its own evidence of truth along with it. Besides which divisions, there were noted from time to time important chronological periods in the development of the prophecy, periods most useful, especially in the case of the great supplemental digressions just spoken of, to fix the order and connection of certain of its constituent parts, the most notable of these periods being that of the time, times and half a time, or 1260 days, as one whereby, not merely, it is to be well observed, was the connection indicated between different parts of the apocalyptic drama, but also between them and certain celebrated prophecies of Daniel, to which the same chronological and most remarkable period attached, thus on the whole, was the most perfect order and plan, as well as the fittest scenery, provided for the due unfolding of the apocalyptic drama. As to the dignity and grandeur of this drama, who can express it? Its subject was nothing less than the prolonged conflict, even to its termination, between the antagonistic powers of Christ's true church and the world. Its moral that, whereas at the beginning, the crown and glory of earthly dominion appeared attached to the potentates of this world, and the church as oppressed and low, at the end, dominion and crown and glory were all seen to pass away from the rulers of this world and to be transferred to the saints and church of Christ. And then, such a theatrical scene, such music, such an audience, how, in the comparison, must the boasted splendor of the grandest of the imperial theatric displays, not long before exhibited in the then proud capital of the world, have seemed to St. John to fade into obscurity, and more especially was its preeminent grandeur manifest in this additional circumstance characterizing it, that the evangelist was admitted, as it were, behind the scenes in the figuration of the great mundane drama. And in what passed in the secret recesses of the Holy of Holies, and permitted to behold him and his activity, who was the almighty overruler of all. I have already just hinted at this matter, and I must now beg for a little while to detain the reader, that he may consider with me beforehand, somewhat in detail, the grand lessons which thus, as the drama proceeded, were set before St. John. First, there was thus manifested to him the real origin of events in the throne of God and of the Lamb. Hence he saw the lightnings, thunderings, and voices that had their echoes in the changes of this world. Hence the commissioning of angels, with their invisible and mysterious agencies. Man is apt in these things to look only to second causes, the inner temple vision. In the exact spirit of Bible history, directed the apostle's eye to the first great cause of them all, in the glorious high throne of the heavenly sanctuary. Second, there was thus strikingly marked out to St. John the very reasons and motives which dictated these counsels of him that sat upon the throne, thus ordering all things, in language alike true and sublime. Our great philosophers depict the mind as the sensorium of the universe, and, as the evangelist marked what was said and what was done in the inner temple, he might see that there was nothing of all that passed on earth unobserved by the divine mind. There, he perceived, came up the memorial of the sins of its inhabitants, while immature as yet, and when fully ripe, each with its own call for judgment. There, in striking contrast, what concerned his own people, his saints of the church militant, not a sigh could escape from, nor a suffering vexed them, but its pulse was evidently felt there. There tended, as to their proper center, the cries of the soul slain beneath the altar, there, as sweet incense, the prayers and adorations of the saints. And then mark the result. It was on the cries of the martyrs rising up that the political heaven, the figure of the supremacy of their oppressors, was seen to pass away. It was in requital of its oppression of the saints that great Babylon was made to drink of the cup of the wrath of God. And amidst all the commotions and changes, the woes and judgments on the earth, he heard declarations made by the Spirit from time to time, and saw heaven-sent visions given to assure his people of the provision made for their safety, and that all things should work together for their good. A third point notable in what passed within the temple, and indeed in what also passed without, was the employment of angelic agency in producing the varied, eventful changes in the world. Most truly, as well as beautifully, it has been said by Milton, millions of spiritual creatures walk the earth unseen, both when we sleep and when we wake. He has said it truly, because it is precisely according to the uniform representations of the Holy Spirit. When the firstborn in Egypt, or the army of the Assyrians, was to be slain, it was by the agency of a destroying angel. When Elisha or Peter was to be delivered, it was still, as represented in Scripture, by angelic instrumentality. Under the present dispensation, we are told, they are employed as ministering spirits to the good, destroying spirits to the evil. Similar was the view presented to St. John in this prophecy. Numbers of them, indeed without number, were seen engaged in the heavenly temple in contemplation and praise, but to others he saw given commissions in the sphere of active employment, and, in fulfillment of these, they appeared afterwards directing the tempests, sounding the trumpets, pouring out the vials, scattering the fire, gathering the vintage. The language indeed is figurative, but the truth I speak of can scarce be mistaken as exhibited under it. Yet once more it was evident, from what passed within, how in time as well as in measure and manner every event was ordered, even to the minutest accuracy. That infinite mind was seen to be to itself its own measure of succession. There was marked the passage and progress of time, alike in its minutest moments and largest cycles, the hour and day and month and year, the times, times and half a time, one day as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day, the exact and fittest moment of loosing or restraining, of deliverance or judgment, the hour known to no man, no, not to the angels in heaven, of the harvest and the vintage, of the mystery of God ending, the consummation of all things, the day of judgment. I must not forget to observe, in conclusion, that wheresoever explanation might be needed, each class of the blessed ones present in the temple scene appeared prompt to communicate with the evangelist. From the elders there came one to point out the palm-bearing multitude to him, and tell their origin and their history. An angel was the party to show him the closing scene of Babylon, and the glories of the New Jerusalem. Lastly, voices of an unseen one from heaven, as of the Spirit of Yahuwah, spake from time to time to him, of what he was writing, as if superintending it, in order that there might be in it no error, no deception. And Jesus himself, the beloved one of his soul, as he had begun the revelation, so in his own person, and with his own promise ended it, "Surely I come quickly." It was a beautiful exemplification of that union and communion of the saints below with the beings of a higher order above, of which St. Paul had written to the Hebrew Christians, "Ye are come to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven, and the spirits of just men made perfect, and an innumerable company of angels, and Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, and God the judge of all." Indeed, the whole passage is more illustrative of the subject we have been discussing, for if we include its previous and commencing clause, "Ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem," it brings before us the very scene in part, as well as celestial company present in the apocalyptic visions, insomuch that I cannot believe the resemblance fortuitous. The ideal imagery seems to me to have been dictated by God's Spirit to one apostle, almost purposely as the intended prototype of what was here, some 30 years after, to be visibly presented to another in the visions of Patmos. For no scripture is of a private interpretation, but holy men spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our Listen and Schedule pages on the Internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe, so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Horae Apocalypticae, Volume 1, an historicist commentary on the Revelation, updated and revised for the 21st century, derived from the original work of E.B. Eliot, updated, revised, and read by yours truly, Nicholas Arthur. Introduction to The Prophecy of the Future. Chapter 5, on the ensuing historical exposition of the Revelation. And now, as to the conclusion of this introductory part, let us consider the principles, plan, and evidence of truth that may be found to characterize the following exposition of the apocalyptic prophecy. Its subject matter, I perceive, to be primarily the continuous fortunes of the church and of the world, that is, of the Roman world and Christian church settled therein, from the time of the revelation being given, or time of St. John's banishment, to the end of all things. This, its commencing date, I consider, as already observed, to have been fixed by Christ's own words. I will show thee things that must happen after these things. If the words "these things" means the present state at the time of the apocalyptic churches, as described in the seven epistles, a point which, I suppose, few will doubt, then must Christ's declaration, as it seems to me, distinctly and necessarily imply that the future foreshown should begin from the present time of John's banishment, or soon thereafter. This is indeed admitted by most competent judges. And the importance of this principle on historical exposition of the apocalypse, thus being fixed as to its commencement, cannot be overestimated. It sets aside of itself what there is indeed, as I think, superabundant other so-called evidence, interpretations based on the principle of the apocalypse being a prophecy figurative only of the times yet future of the second advent. I believe the Greek must have positive violence done to it in order to extract therefrom any other meaning than that which I here offer. In the divine foreshowing of its great subject, I am persuaded, and have carried out my exposition on the persuasion, that the two following rules must be observed. First, that the epochs and events selected for prefiguration must be such as are confessed to be the most important and eventful. Secondly, that the figuring emblems must be, in some approved consistent sense, characteristic and distinctive. Such would be the case were a mastermind among men to develop the great general subject in a series of descriptive sketches or pictures. How, then, can we suppose it to be otherwise in the prefiguration authored by the omniscient Spirit? The direct evidence of truth hence arising, in case of agreement between the symbol and the historical object it is applied to, will at once be felt by the intelligent reader, and being not expounded after the interpreter's own fancy, that being too often a prophetic exposition, but in a sense, as I said, approved, that is, according to their recognized meaning, more especially at the time and in the country supposed to be referred to, or perhaps as otherwise fixed, e.g., by some local or geographical peculiarity strongly marked in the prefiguration. Of course, the evidence will be felt strong in proportion to the number of details combined in the symbol, their distinctiveness of character, and the exactness of their application to the era and the subject. it might be expected a priori, and will be found, in fact, that in the long series of prophetic figurations, there will be some more circumstantial, distinctive, and striking than others, and some indeed quite brief, and comparatively general in character. But the former will be found, I believe, much more frequent than the latter, and abundantly sufficient in frequency and strength to serve as effectual buttresses to the sacred building, and to support its continuity unbroken. Nor will the seeker for truth fail to consider the argument cumulative in this case, and how, if in a long continuous series of prefiguration, one and another, each in its precise order of time, be shown to have had its fulfillment, the strength of the evidence of truth thereby rapidly increase each step, indeed, with almost the rapidity of geometrical progression. Besides which direct evidence the reader will find offered from time to time in the ensuing exposition, a species of indirect evidence, hitherto unnoticed, I believe, of the nature of what I may call elusive contrast. Examples will best illustrate it, but I may thus briefly explain its nature. Supposing the great subject of the apocalyptic revelation to be the history in advance, in connection or in contrast, of Christ's faithful church and of the world, of the latter, either in its primary state of avowed heathenism, or its subsequent state of corruption and apostasy under the Christian name, then, just as in God's actual interventions at one and another crisis for the revival of his church and vindication of his own rights and honor, the revelations of gospel light and truth made by him would be necessarily in marked contrast and opposition to the then prevalent errors and corruptions. So in the eternal Spirit's foreshowing of the same, a similarly marked contrast must be expected to appear. On putting the apocalyptic picturing of the heavenly revelation side by side with the historic picturing of the chronologically correspondent corruption and heresy. The same also, partially, in the Spirit's prefiguration sketching, from time to time, of its faithful ones, faithful among the faithless. Some three or four examples of this will be substantiated, if I mistake not, in the ensuing commentary, especially in Revelation 7, 8, and 10, the view of St. John in his representative character, hitherto quite barren of results, furnishing under this head, as well as under the former, most important accessions of evidence. Nor let me pass on without just hinting the theological importance of each such substantiated elusive prefiguration, inasmuch as it must not merely present evidence of the fulfillment of prophecy in matters of historic fact, but evidence of the divine judgment in matters of religious doctrine. With regard to the plan, order, and chief divisions of the exposition ensuing, they have already been almost intimated in the preceding chapter, for that which an expositor may have declared to be, in his opinion, the most natural plan, order, and chief divisions of the prophecy, though self-same, except for very cogent reasons, he ought, of course, to follow out in his own exposition. Accordingly, the three septenaries of seals, trumpets, and vials will be interpreted by me as all connected and consecutive series, the seventh seal unfolding itself in the seventh trumpet visions, the seventh trumpet in those of the seven vials, and this with no intermission or interruption, save only that of the supplemental, retrogressive part, marked as such by clear internal evidence, which I suppose to have occupied the outside of the apocalyptic scroll. Hitherto this scheme of arrangement has not, I believe, been consistently developed. There are some expositors who, through admitting the conclusiveness of the three septenaries, have yet encumbered its development by the surely strained supposition of the seven-sealed book containing but a part of the revelation, and its other and larger part being inscribed in the little book held by the rainbow-crowned angel of Revelation 10. Others, again, have explained the witness's death and resurrection, noted apocalyptically under the sixth trumpet, as having reference to events long subsequent to those which are the main subject of that trumpet, and indeed to the sounding of the seventh trumpet after it, hence an involved structure at best, with a proportional want of the self-evidence of the simplicity of truth. And turning from the prophecy to the history, there seem to me on the whole to be six chief parts, or acts, clearly defined in the sacred drama prefigured before us. A division well agreeing with that more obvious one already noted, of the succession of the seals, trumpets, and vials, their historic subject matter being, respectively, as follows. 1. That of the coming temporary prosperity, and then the decline and fall of pagan Rome, before the power of Christianity, the subject of the first six seals. 2. The ravage and destruction of Rome Christian, after its apostasy, in its divisions, both of East and West, of the Western Empire by the Goths, of the Eastern by the Saracens and Turks, the subject of the first six trumpets. 3. The history of the Reformation, as introduced about the middle of the sixth trumpet. 4. The supplemental and explanatory history of the rise, character, acting of the papacy and papal empire, which sprung out of the Gothic inundations of Western Europe, a part corresponding, as I conceive, with the writing without the prophetic scroll, and which was exhibited preparatory to the prefiguration of the papal overthrow. 5. The preliminary judgments on, and then the overthrow of, the papacy and papal empire, under the outpouring of the vials of God's wrath, followed by the coming of Christ in judgment, consequent on which is depicted. 6. The glorious consummation, including the reign of Christ and his saints on the renovated earth, and then the descent of the heavenly Jerusalem, of which parts the first four seem to me to have been accomplished already, and the fifth, the prefigured events, to be now well advanced in progress of fulfillment. In the following treatise it is my purpose, first, to trace the historical fulfillment of the four former parts, together with that of the first six vials of the fifth part, more at length then in regard of the remainder, as yet unfulfilled, to inquire briefly and cautiously into the grander and more prominent points that may seem prefigured in it, as destined to take place in the coming future, the circumstance of the fifth prophetic division having been only in main part fulfilled, as I view it, in part still future, will cause this measure of divergence in my actual arrangement from the division just sketched, that I shall include what seems to me unfulfilled of the fifth part under the sixth and last of the prophecy. But what a field for the historic research lies here before us, a field extending over 17 centuries, and over countries many more than those of European Christendom, with reference to which point, and ere I enter on the exposition, let me call upon the reader to admire with me the divine wisdom in so ordering things that, amidst the partial wreck that there has been of the literary records of some of the centuries here prefigured, and the original scarcity of those of others, especially of the earlier part of the dark Middle Ages, there should yet remain to us documentary evidence sufficient whereby to illustrate almost all of the events foreshown, and to evince the truth and accuracy of the prefiguration. And again, let me suggest it as a thing admirable, that he should have so overruled the intellectual tendencies of a mind like Gibbon's in these latter days as to direct it to the development of the same period and nearly the same subject as the larger half of the apocalyptic prophecy. It is scarcely needful, I presume, to detail his peculiar qualifications as an illustrator and a witness, endowed as he was with the powers of research and memory very rare, and an absolute enthusiasm in his subject, such as precisely the best to fit him for searching out historic truth, even where most obscure, endowed, too, with a comprehensive view and philosophic sagacity, which led him, instinctively almost, to mark the relations of things, trace results to their causes, and, amidst the multiplicity of details, to appreciate the real importance and grand bearing of events and epochs. Besides the being possessed of a turn of mind and imagination, eminently dramatic and picturesque, such as to suggest a development of his general subject with no lack of dramatic unity of effect, and a grouping and painting of the details and graphic descriptions, that approach, as near almost as descriptive language can do, to the mode of exhibiting them here chosen, vis-a-vis, by actual pictures. Thus was the infidel Gibbon prepared to become unconsciously the best illustrator of no small part of the prophecy, that self-same heavenly prophecy which he has himself made the subject of a sneer. The absolute need of such a pioneer to apocalyptic interpretation has been well set forth by Michaelis in his sketch of the prerequisites for a proper apocalyptic expositor. Nor is there anyone that can so fully, as the expositor himself, appreciate the immense advantage derivable from his pioneering work. It is, however, an advantage in which the reader may also participate. Gibbon's work on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire offers him a book of reference easily accessible, and in secular history almost always to be depended upon, whereby himself to test the correctness of the historic views and statements propounded to him by the expositor. It will be my object to facilitate such reference. The use will soon appear.